There are many ways in which industrialization has served to make food cheap. One way is to subvert the growth of natural competitors, like weeds, with herbicides, like glyphosate. This leads us to ask, what happens to the chemicals after they have been used to make food cheap?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Welcome. This is the 1346th edition of the Food Chain Radio program. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Lago Como who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com or Spotify or any of another of a dozen places. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, in the 1930s, people began the big migration from the farm into the city. Those farmers who were left on the farm began growing food with money, which they used to buy equipment and chemicals to do the work that people once did. Thus, it became cheaper to grow food with money than with people. This industrialization of the food chain has proceeded apace without pause ever since. And now the world is literally drenched in the agricultural chemicals used to grow food. Broadly speaking, there are two kinds of chemicals used to grow food: fertilizers and pesticides. Fertilizers provide the nutrient elements plants need to grow and develop, among them nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, the macronutrients. Pesticides provide farmers with the ability to fight off natural competitors for the growth and development of their crops, and include herbicides that kill weeds, fungicides that fight off diseases, and insecticides that kill insects. The herbicide glyphosate, which travels under the trade name Roundup, is one of the most widely used chemicals in agriculture. Since 1974, 18.9 billion pounds of glyphosate have been sprayed on the world. Use of glyphosate has increased 15-fold since the introduction of crops genetically modified to withstand the glyphosate, thereby killing weeds without killing your crops. That our world is literally drenched in a chemical that the World Health Organization claims is a probable cause of cancer leads us to ask, what happens to the chemicals after they have been used to make food cheap? Well, here to help us look for an answer, we have Dr. John Fagan, who is the co-founder and CEO and chief scientist of Health Research Institute. Welcome to the Food Chain, Dr. Fagan. Pleased to have you aboard today.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be here. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Me too. And thanks to Howard Vlieger for pointing the way to this conversation. Always appreciate his contributions to the Food Chain Radio Show. So, quick thumbnail. Howard told us about the experiment you conducted on yourself with respect to glyphosate. So, in the interest of kicking up some interest in what we're talking about today, what kind of experiment did you conduct on yourself?
It was really fun and interesting. Basically, I wanted to know how quickly I could get the glyphosate out of my system if I stopped eating it. And see, the thing is, we test in our laboratory, we test urine samples from hundreds of people a month that basically are curious about whether they've been exposed to glyphosate. And we give them a result. And the reason that that result is at a certain value is because every day they're eating more glyphosate. And they get rid of it in their urine and other waste materials, even their perspiration. But you're eating more, and so it's there always, basically. But I wanted to know, if I stop eating it and drinking it, how quickly would it go away?
So before you proceed, I'd like to take you back one little notch. Did you say that we actually sweat weed killer?
We do.
Okay, just wanted to make that case then.
Okay, so yeah, that surprise. It's not surprising. It's it comes out. It's also in your hair. We do tests of the hair, and if you know, your hair grows about half an inch, a little more than half an inch a month, and so if you take the hair that is immediately next to your scalp and measure the glyphosate in that, it'll tell you how much glyphosate, how high the levels are that you've been consuming for the last month, basically. And what we did with the urine tests was that I normally eat an organic diet, but I decided I want to contaminate myself with glyphosate at a level that will allow me to see what goes on, but maybe that at least for a short term isn't going to have permanent damage, you might say. And so what I did is I got myself some Quaker oats, because we knew that Quaker oats were full of glyphosate. The old-fashioned variety is what I got. And so so for 5 days in a row, I ate Quaker oats, you know, oatmeal, twice a day, large helpings. And at the end of the, and before that, I tested, and there was some glyphosate there, but it was relatively low. After that 5 days, the levels went way up. They were over 4 nanograms per ml of urine, okay? And then I switched to an all-organic diet and was really careful for the next many days. And what I saw is that over a period of 3.5 days, the glyphosate level went from 4 down to less than 0.4, 0.04, very, very low levels. And all I had done was stop eating it and continuing to have a good diet and drink lots of water. And my system, so there's a good message here, which is that your system has the capability of purifying you, of removing these contaminants before they can be harmful to you. But you're fighting, our system is always fighting against the fact that we're eating these not very good things. And so, and that was what was illustrated to me, because I decided when the glyphosate dropped, I decided, well, I'm going to just continue testing once a day to see what happens with my glyphosate over a period of time. And about 4 or 5 days later, it was still down, but 4 or 5 days later, I went out to lunch with friends and I had a pizza.
Uh-oh.
And the next morning, my levels were up, not as high as with the force-fed Quaker oats, but was up substantially. And then over the next 3.5, 4 days, it dropped back again to that lower level. And so what that told me is that what you eat on a daily basis is going to impact your glyphosate levels in your body. But at the same time, all you have to do is stop eating it. Be careful about what you eat, and you're in good shape.
You know, that is so good news. When you think about it, it's very good news. In bad news, the good news is,
yeah,
it's ubiquitous, yeah, right?
It's ubiquitous. It's in almost the worst are our grains like wheat and corn and oats, and also legumes, black beans, pinto beans. If you eat, things like lentils or dal, is a common thing like that. Or if you're into, and we all think that what's the stuff they make from garbanzo beans? The
hummus.
Yeah, we all think hummus is so healthy for us, but in fact, they use tons of glyphosate on hummus. And what happens there is that with these grains and beans, they're not using that so much to fight weeds. They use it at the end of the season to desiccate or kill the crop. So it's all dry and crispy when they drive the combine through it. And so about 2 weeks before they're ready to harvest, they spray the field with glyphosate. And oftentimes, there isn't even a rain between the time that they spray with glyphosate and the time they harvest. So these grains and legumes, and they also do it with potatoes, believe it or not. These things are drenched in glyphosate. They have the highest levels I've ever seen in foods, basically.
So the vegetarian food that everybody thinks is very healthy because it's not meat is actually drenched in an herbicide that will go right into your body and reside there until you take action to get rid of it.
Exactly. Yeah, it's really true. And in fact, milk and dairy and also meat is lower in glyphosate than the plants. And the reason for this is that the livestock's body is just as efficient at removing those things as your body is. So they're sort of functioning as a filter so that you avoid those things. If you look at the urine of a cow, for instance, or of a pig, or your pet dog, you'll discover that they have much higher levels. Their glyphosate levels can be 50 nanograms per ml, or I've even seen as high as 100-150. And these are animals that are exposed to very high levels. But by the time you drink the milk, it's the levels, there can be a little bit there, but it's much lower.
Okay.
And also with
I was just thinking that the pet food manufactured here in the United, probably everywhere, pet food is manufactured using grains that have been drenched in glyphosate, right?
Yeah, and also other pesticides. In fact, as you might be aware, there's quite a lot of people who are concerned about glyphosate now. And you can find foods on the market that say glyphosate-free. Huh. Now, that means that some farmer was told to grow their oats or their beans without glyphosate.
Amen to that. We're going to take a quick break here, Doctor.
Okay.
But when we come back, I'd like to pick up the whole subject of glyphosate because it was hugely in the news not so long ago, and everybody was suing Monsanto and whatnot, but it's kind of faded to dark. I'm wondering about that. I'd like to pick it up when we come back with Dr. John Fagan. Do stay tuned.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
He was the co-founder, CEO, and chief scientist of Health Research Institute, and he looks into our body and sees things that we can't see. Namely, the chemicals that have been used to make food cheap. Dr. Fagan, you got a follow-up?
Yeah, I just have a quick follow-up on what we were talking about before, and that is that because farmers are now frequently asked to grow their crop without glyphosate, they say, oh, okay, so I can use this other chemical. And one of the chemicals that they're frequently using to replace the herbicide glyphosate is paraquat. Paraquat is a much worse pesticide. It has been demonstrated to be high risk. You could say a cause of Parkinson's disease. and other neurological problems. So the whole chemical paradigm is what we must be concerned about. And it is crazy to have even started it. The idea that we're going to put poisons on our food, where did anybody come up with that? It's just, it's not intuitive.
No, it's not, is it? As a matter of fact, it's crazy. But science, a lot of science says it's okay to do. And Dr. Fagan, here's a question I've been dying to ask you. As a molecular, a PhD molecular biologist, science of the molecules, I see signs now that popped up, I think, pretty much from the beginning of the pandemic. And one of they have little sayings on them, you know, yard signs. And one of them that says, science is real. I don't have the slightest idea what that means. Do you?
I think that it comes out of the, you know, the fake news kind of thing that we've all been confronted with in the last few years, where people make up their own reality. And depending on which side of the political spectrum you're on, you're saying, well, the people over there are making up their own reality. And the people over there are saying the people over there are doing it. So it's a hard thing to resolve, but that's probably what's going on there. And that somebody who appreciates traditional science is saying it's real. You need to listen to it, even if it doesn't fit with your other beliefs in the world, you know. So it's interesting.
Okay. Well, I suspect if Dr. John Fagan had a sign on his front yard, it would say, seeing is believing. Because what you do at your institute is help us see the chemicals in our bodies that have been used in making food cheap, which is to say to replace people with chemicals and thereby making it cheaper to grow food. But there are so many different kinds of chemicals. How many? How many can you track, doctor?
Oh, well, literally thousands. And we use mass spectroscopy for what we do. And we can literally, in a single analytical run, measure between 1,500 and 4,000 different compounds. And there are going to be some of them that are just tiny amounts, but there are others that will be very, very prominent. But we can look at the whole spectrum that way. And we use this, we use it for looking at the bad guys, but we also use it for looking at the good guys, because it turns out that human beings have only begun to scratch the surface of what molecules are present in the foods that we eat. So, that's a whole nother story. And I think it's one that's more fascinating.
I do too. I love that story. Yeah. Because it especially applies to plants as well, right? I often think of agriculture, a farmer spraying nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium on his crop and calling it a day. And the crop grows up. But plants use much more than NPK. They use a number of different things. And it's who knows how much they need of this and how much they need of that. Only the plant really knows.
Absolutely. You know, and they're the master chemists, because they're in a plant is in a very tricky situation. They plant the roots. They can't move. You know, if you're sitting in a room and somebody blows smoke on you, you can get up and walk away. The plant can't do that. What they do instead is they are master chemists, and they can produce compounds that will repel the bugs or help them help protect them from water loss if it's a very dry season or things like that. So they're brilliant, and they produce tens of thousands of compounds that you can that can be very nourishing to you. And in fact, over our evolutionary history, we've evolved with the plants, and we benefit from so many of the things that they produce.
Autotrophic metabolisms. They're self-feeding.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. Now, what happens if they do not have the right nutrition in the right amount at the right time? Then they do not have the ability to do all of those magical things in their plant laboratory that they need to do to feed us. I often wonder, Doctor, if we are what we eat, are we not also what our food eats?
We are. We're absolutely that. And there, you know, there was a study done in the early 90s that showed that between the 1940s and the early 90s, the nutritional value of most vegetables dropped precipitously. And that's that is the period during which this chemical approach to agriculture really became dominant in America. And what it did, now we understand it. We didn't understand it even in the 90s. But now we understand that what many of the NPK, what we call fertilizer does, as well as the pesticides, is they kill the microorganisms in soil. And those microorganisms are operating in symbiosis with the plants. And the plants give them some things, and the microorganisms mine the mineral in the soil and make them available for the plant. And if the microorganisms aren't there to do it, the plant is in a state of starvation, basically. And they can only produce, you know, and the result is that the tomatoes or the beans or the whatever, the wheat that is produced, doesn't have the minerals that it needs.
So these chemicals are coming at us from two different directions. One, they're coating our food with toxic chemicals. Glyphosate has been called a probable cause of cancer, and paraquat, Parkinson's disease, and so on and so on and so on and so on. So there's danger from that direction. And then there's danger from the direction of the chemicals, fertilizers, killing the microorganisms in the soil that make the food available to the food we eat. So two different directions.
Yeah, it's a big concern. It really is.
So what you do is help people see the consequence of that chemical activity, because we can't see it. You know, you spray glyphosate on something and the crop withers and dies, but you can't see any glyphosate around anywhere. Same is true with paraquat and all the rest of the chemicals. So Dr. John Fagan steps in and figures out what's in our body, because he has a health research institute and he has the equipment to look way down deep. How deep can you see?
That's a good question. We can see compounds. We can detect compounds that are present in, you know, one part in one plus 15,000 zeros. Or 15 zeros, okay? So it's like huge number, you know, very, very tiny amounts. Less than a trillion, one trillionth, basically. And so it's really very powerful that what we can detect. And the message is that the message that we are coming up with is that although there is this bad agriculture going on out there, there's also good agriculture. And the regenerative and organic approaches that are being taken, and so many of America's farmers are waking up to this now, that the farmers who are using these techniques are producing food that takes us back before that chemical revolution began to take place. to produce food that is really nourishing. And we've actually been measuring that higher quality of food. And what we're hoping, the big hope for us, is not just to say, oh, here are the bad things, but to say, here's the good food over here. Take this home to your kids. And then you're going to be treating, you're going to give them what they need to really grow and become strong and healthy, and for yourself as well. So that's what we're working on both sides of that, you know?
I would think that there are those in industry who do not like what you do.
Of course. You know, the people who are trying to sell the pesticides and the fertilizers, they want the world to believe that chemical agriculture is the savior of mankind. And, you know, you can hear that kind of thing. You can go on online and go to many, many organizations that espouse that belief. But it's a money-driven belief. That's all I can say about it. It's driven by technology that lines the pockets of big companies.
Well, I think their great promise was that they have freed us from the toil of laboring on the land in order for us to do more productive things, like sit in front of a computer screen all day, things like that.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But the promise is cheap food. That's the essential promise. So when we look at what you're saying and what you're seeing with your full spectrum molecular analysis, is that food is the true value of food is being attacked from two different directions. One, from the fertilizers that destroy the soil organisms that make it harder for our plants to develop their full new spectrum of nutrition. And the other direction is from the toxic chemicals that saturate the food and end up in our body. So there should be some way of measuring the true value of food. That it's cheaper to make doesn't mean it's cheaper to eat.
Or that it's cheaper for society as a whole. It doesn't mean that at all, you know, because you have to consider, well, how healthy are the people who do this? How much health care, how many trips to the doctor, and how many drugs do they have to take, and all of that kind of thing? And what's the impact on the environment? Then you discover that there are problems like, you know, the World Health the WHO says that we have maybe 60 harvests left until the soil is so depleted that we can't feed the population.
Did you say 60 harvests left?
Probably now more like 55. More like 55. Because we're not really taking care of the problem yet. But and that's really what motivates what we do, is that we are trying to alert people to better food, but it's better not just for nutrition, it's better for the planet, it's better for our soil, it's better for the future of humanity to eat food that's been produced by these regenerative approaches, these organic approaches that create food that is more nutritious and better for the planet.
Well, you have a tough job ahead of you, but there are a lot of people who are hearing you and wondering what they can do. Well, we're going to be taking a quick break here pretty quick. Now, these chemicals are ubiquitous, are they not? They're everywhere in our environment.
Yes.
In all of our food. Unless that food is organic, correct? Or is it even in organic food?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yes, you will find it in organic at much lower levels, but you'll find it there. And hopefully at levels that are not going to cause drastic toxicity, let's put it that way.
Okay, so we're going to be taking a quick break, but when we come back, I'm going to ask Dr. John Fagan from the Institute how he goes about helping us see what he sees. He has these incredible machines and equipment that can look way, way, way down deep into a food molecule and tell us what's in it, what kind of pesticide is in it. And he's going to tell us how he can help us do the same thing, which would be greatly appreciated because I'm curious. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Hitting What with Dr. John Fagan, Health Research Institute. He will be right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, the chemicals that are used to make food cheap are ubiquitous in our food and in our environment, in us. Dr. John, do we have any idea of what percentage of the population have glyphosate in our bodies?
We have done work on that, and about 80% of the population has measurable, quantifiable levels of glyphosate. That's in the population that we've tested. And those are typically people who had enough interest to actually buy a test and take it home and use it.
Wow.
And so you might think that people who are less interested in their health might even be more likely to have it. So I would say 80% is a minimum. There could easily be 90% or more of the people who are exposed. On average, that
okay.
are exposed.
Point being, we're drenched in glyphosate and many other agricultural chemicals because it's what we use. Those chemicals are what we use to make our food cheap. And so what does Dr. John can see those things, but he can also help us see if we need to, if we're curious, what chemicals we have in our body. How do you go about doing that, Dr. John Fagan?
Uh-huh. Well, we are a what's called a CLIA, a high complexity CLIA approved lab. That means that the FDA has approved our laboratory for analysis of human samples. So we have measured glyphosate and other pesticides in urine and blood and amniotic fluid and many other materials that way. And what we use those measurements of mass spectroscopy to quantify the amounts of these toxins that are present. And it's very common that we see these things.
And would it be possible to describe that process in layman's terms for poor people like me who get lost?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So we've got you provide a urine sample. The best thing is first thing in the morning, you fill this little cup with that has a sealed top on it. You fill that cup and you then put it in a mailer and send it to us. And at the lab, we open that up and we take a sample out and we mix some chemicals in it to make the analysis process work. And then we introduce that sample, part of that sample, we introduce it into a mass spectroscopy system. And this will measure any molecule that's present in that sample will be detectable in the mass spec. But for this kind of analysis, we program the mass spec to look specifically for glyphosate. And it would then determine the amount of glyphosate that's present in very small amounts. It'll be there, but it will be present. And when I say small amounts, because it's nanomolar, You know, that means like a 1/1,000,000,000th of a mole of a one. How to put it? It's very, very small. It just drops in a swimming pool.
And yeah, how about this? Undescribably small.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Or you can think of it, take an eyedropper and put one drop into a swimming pool. And that would be about the volume that we would be looking at there.
Wow.
So, that's tiny. But those concentrations are important for your health, because those very low levels of toxins like glyphosate are enough to cause cancer or to cause other diseases. Glyphosate also causes cirrhosis of the liver, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease has been associated with glyphosate. And there are other problems, too, that come with it. And so it's, you know, these are, and it's the case with all of these chemicals. Literally, the typical vegetable from the grocery store is going to contain somewhere between 5 and 8 different pesticides. Now, any one of them may be at a very low level, but when you add them all together, it's like there's an entourage effect there where they can work together. And the research has not been done to sort all that out. So we don't know how dangerous these mixtures are that we're being exposed to every day. But we can guess that they're probably not very good for us.
So a quick jump in here now. What you're saying is that you're not just eating one pesticide. You're eating maybe 5 in the average grocery bag. And each one of those chemicals has particular effects on your body. But when you add one with another, and then another, and then another, and then another, nobody knows what the impact of that will be on your body. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's too complicated. Yeah, and for the studies that have been done show that they not only can act at the same time, but they can synergize each other. They can, the presence of one compound can make the negative effects of another compound even greater. So there are, you know, there have been studies showing that kind of thing happening. So it's a pretty, it's a serious thing that we're doing, putting all of those chemicals together. And in your grocery, in any one apple, you may have 5 or 8. But in your grocery bag, you may have 20 different pesticides, you know, when you add them all up.
Wow. So, Dr. John Fagan, you must drive the chemical industry bonkers with the fact that you can see their chemicals in parts per zillion. And they must say to you, in such a little amount, you're driving us crazy. It can't possibly harm somebody. But there really is no science that says that it doesn't either, because they have not done the science on what happens when you combine a little of this and a little of that with a little of 20 other things. There's just no science, is there?
Not on that. We haven't done the homework that we should have done. We're putting those things out there before we know what they can do to people. It's this is not science. This is not science. But just to make it clear, the levels of any one of those is probably toxic to a certain extent. And, they'll say, it's much below the EPA level. But if you look at the level, if you look at the science that's been done on glyphosate, you look at the science on it, and then you look at what the EPA or the European Food Safety Agency allows as being safe, or even California, which is more stringent than the EPA by 100 or 1,000-fold, you find that the levels that they say are acceptable or safe are, you know, that there's research that has been done that shows that those levels can harm people. And yet they're allowed on the market. Mm-hmm. And when somebody tries to, when there's pressure to, the most recent one is chlorpyrifos, which is one of the nasty chemicals out there. And there was pressure put on the government to ban chlorpyrifos, not only for health reasons for people, but for what it does to the wildlife and the bees.
The
and
bees, yeah. It's the bee killer.
It's the bee killer. And anything that kills the bees kills our ability to feed humanity, because bees are essential to pollinating most crops. So anyway, there's a logic for getting rid of the chlorpyrifos, but the big companies lobbied back very strongly, and now there's pressure in the other direction. So we'll see what happens with chlorpyrifos in the long term, but it's not been a pretty story.
Do you see any parallels between ag chemicals and pharmaceuticals?
Absolutely. It's the same, essentially different parts of the same industry. They play back and forth against each other or with each other. And the same kinds of, and I'm not an expert in this area, but the same kinds of public relations moves have been used for the pharmaceutical industry, for the agrochemical industry, for the tobacco industry. They are all using the same strategies to delay and weaken the resistance against them. It's unfortunate.
Let's talk about the ways in which you help people fight back, fight for clean food, fight for a clean environment. You help them look and see what's in their body. And if you see, you can believe. So you partnered up with some folks called Tested Clean, which fascinates me because it seems like it might just be the ultimate organic label. Is it?
Oh, that's a great question. And yes, it's essentially Tested Clean is a certification that assures that it's not possible to say that something is free of pesticides because they're so ubiquitous. But it says that we have tested it and the levels are very, very low, and low enough. So we actually are doing risk assessments, and whereas the government risk assessments are heavily influenced by industry, we can just look at the science and say, well, what's really the case? And on that basis, we can set thresholds for most pesticides and other chemicals that we feel are much closer to safety than what is out there. Now, we can't say it's safe. We never will do that. But we'll certainly say that it's safer.
That's scary, don't you think? That we cannot say that the food we eat is safe. What happened to us?
It's pathological. The concept of putting poisons on our food. Who thought that up? And how did they sell the whole culture, the whole society, on that idea?
It's easy to see. Yeah, it's easy for me to see why they did it, because I was once a teenage herbicide myself. And I didn't like the job of walking along rows of growing plants with a sharp hoe in the heat of the sun and hoeing weeds. I wanted to go away and did. And so they got rid of me. What are they going to do about the weeds? Oh, look. What about this glyphosate? It'll kill weeds. And then they discovered how they could genetically engineer plants so that the plants would withstand the glyphosate, so they could spray the glyphosate on the entire crop, kill the weeds, and not the plant. So it's easy to see why they wanted to do that. But it's not so easy to see it. I once had a conversation with some biotech engineers at a conference. And I told them that you guys are geniuses for what you have done. Your genetic technology has liberated farmers. It made it possible for one farmer to grow 10,000 acres of crop with no weeds. Wow. But someday, consumers are going to come to you and say, hey, what's in this for us other than food that has been drenched in poison? Isn't that where we're at now?
Yeah, that's where we are. And what did they say?
They smiled. It was a whole room full of them. And they mm-hmm. said, there's nothing they can say. And they haven't said anything. I told them they're going to have to come up with an answer. And they haven't yet. They have no answer. What would you tell them to say as a scientist?
I would suggest that they say, okay, we give up. Because in reality, that is what's going to happen, is that because there's an old saying, it is truth ultimately triumphs. And the time will come when we finally get down there and say, okay, I guess you're right. We shouldn't be using these things on our food. But I believe that's probably that mechanisms like tested clean are going to be really important in that, because it gives the consumer the ability at the store to look at a product, and if it has that seal on it, they know, okay, it's a lot safer.
And there we are. Dr. John Fagan, thank you so much for joining us on The Food Chain. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for tuning in. Remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't. Thank you, Dr. John.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends miss the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.